This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Dave Eggers couldn't figure it out. He was horrified by the idea of Donald Trump becoming elected, and he was determined to understand what was going on. At first, he thought the best way he could do that is cover the election, which he did. He was particularly interested in the Trump rallies. But he couldn't figure it out, because when he would talk to supporters, instead of crazy, hateful, unreasonable people, he says he encountered something else.
Very dignified, polite, kind-hearted people I knew were leaning his way, and I felt like that was a disconnect given how crude and impolite and unkind he is, without debate. And so I just wanted to meet and see what the rallies were like, because we had been led to believe, I think, by a lot of media coverage that these were very sort of intense, kind of nasty hate fests. But this was nothing like that. It was a very warm, kind of mellow crowd that looked exactly like you'd see people lining up for a minor league baseball game. So I learned a lot there. There were just so many thoughtful people that had found one reason or another, or maybe very narrow reasons, to support Trump's candidacy and now continue to support his presidency.
One people, one family.
Finally, we have a president that gets it and is there.
He says the things that needs to be said, the truth.
He doesn't have to answer to any donors, any lobbyists.
I'm one of the angry voters that they've been discussing.
Our president is the man of the people.
Go Trump!
Today, I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
And you know what? I want to make this point because I just went to a rally last week in Hershey, Pennsylvania. This was the day the articles of impeachment were handed down, and this was 3 hours in the driving rain, and this is the heart of Trump country. And I wait in line. So if there was to be anything really hateful or terrifying, I guess, to be seen or heard, I would hear it, because I'm there in line with everyone else without any press credentials or anything. And after all this time, I have yet to experience any of that. People were pretty grim, you know, outside. But then you go inside, and it has kind of the festive atmosphere of a concert. They are buying chips and salsa and chicken fingers, and you know, it's got kind of a semi-party atmosphere, because Trump's rallies are entertainments.
And hello, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
It's great to be back in the state that gave us the Liberty Bell.
And that's what I think people have to remember, is that this is a free ticket to basically an hour and a half of mostly comedy, or Trump is entertaining his crowd like a comedian would. And so this particular rally, the first 45 minutes were like a comedy show. It was mostly jokes.
You're so lucky I became your president, Donald. I'm only kidding. I have to say I'm kidding.
And he seemed incredibly at ease and incredibly unbothered by the articles of impeachment.
They're impeaching me, and there are no crimes. This has to be a first in history. They're impeaching me. You know why? Because they want to win an election, and that's the only way they can do it.
And then, you know, afterward, I interview people, and I always find such thoughtful and surprisingly nuanced views about Trump's policies and his failures and also his strengths. And so I come away thinking people are much more malleable as an electorate than you'd expect. Mm-hmm. But also, because of the people kept on telling me that they have more money in their pocket this year than they did last year, that's going to be hard to beat.
Yeah.
You know, when you have $2,500 more, $3,000 more in your pocket, that is hard to run against, no matter what you think about his tweets.
But the more Eggers worked on the story of Trump's election, the less he felt he could rely on conventional journalism. And what he came up with was not even close to journalism. But that's not new to Eggers. He's written fiction and nonfiction. He's combined the two. He's written books for young readers. He founded the publishing house McSweeney's. His novel slash memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, was nominated for a Pulitzer. It was a massive hit. But this time, for the Trump era, he came up with a farce, a short parable, not much more than 100 pages. It's about a ship called the Glory, which has recently lost its captain. And the man the passengers have chosen to replace him is a man with a yellow feather in his hair. He's loud and clownish. He lies constantly, but he promises to shake things up. The book is called The Captain and the Glory, an entertainment. You've described the story you made as kind of gaudy and garish, I think is how you put it. Can you talk about when you settled on a kind of a farce in a parable?
Well, I think I'd been covering the era as a journalist maybe 6 to 8 months or so, or maybe a year, when it seemed like I would finish a piece and it would be just as nuanced, I think, as the people I had met. Yeah. And I always come away really liking the people I interview. And I just, you know, in Hershey, I liked the people I interviewed so much, even though I don't agree with them on a lot of issues. But they were all so willing to talk and really explain their thinking and very openly and thoughtfully. But then you take a step back and you remember that this is really one of the more bizarre moments in American history. It is so absurd from a distance, so beyond any kind of precedent. I mean, I'm not the first to say that. But every day there is something that, you know, would sink any other candidate or would be considered so embarrassing that you could never recover. I mean, last week we found out which kind of makeup that the president wears. And he's wearing, you know, concealer on every part of his body apparently. And it's orange in color. So that we actually have confirmation of the exact product that he slathers on himself in addition to what we know about his hair dye and his hair concoction, how he does that. And so just on a very superficial level, we have a very, like, it's completely impossible to make up how ludicrous some of these things are and how vain. But and so in addition to just every other absurd aspect of this presidency, and beginning with these tweets that are barely grammatically plausible, full of misspellings, all caps, accusations, bullying, the most childish, not to insult children there, but the most immature sort of behavior coming from the White House. And so I've been vacillating for a couple of years between getting really into covering this era and the effect of its policies on real people, but then at the same time backing up and saying, you know, the best way almost to reflect the absurd aspects of the era might be an absurdist parable that, you know, that best sort of captures the mood and what we're going to remember from it.
I get the farce part, you know, the absurd part. Let me ask about the parable part. Do you see in some way, or did you think about this as conveying a larger kind of stylized lesson, you know, like a parable does?
Yeah, I think a parable has a way of stripping away all the unnecessary detail. bringing it back to the core, bringing it back to its lessons, and sometimes making it simple enough to see the shape of things as they are, and not without muddying them too much. I think in this case, instead of 320 million people, I've reduced it to a few thousand people on a ship, mm-hmm. and instead of there isn't a DC and there isn't all these countries. I mean, states. It's a few thousand people that consider themselves sort of a nation state aboard what essentially is a cruise ship. And so the cruise ship itself is sort of inherently comical. I think cruise ships are comical as a entity.
And it helps you contain the story, I guess, too.
And it contains the story. And, yeah. You know, you limit the cast of characters pretty drastically to a handful. And I think thus you can sort of see things a little bit better. And you combine a bunch of characters. I sort of combined all of his conspiracy partners, from Alex Jones to Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon, into one entity who's known as the voice in the vent, who the captain listens to while he's hiding under his bed.
And the fact that this ship, the Glory, is headed somewhere – I saw that as important. Like the direction of state seemed kind of critical to me.
Well, eventually it's sort of headed somewhere, but they spend the first 50 pages of the book, I think, going nowhere.
Right,
because the
right.
captain hasn't thought about where he might want to go. He just wanted the job.
Yeah.
And so I think that we saw a lot of that in the first year of Trump's presidency. He hadn't staffed most of the positions. He hadn't thought anything through. It was the roughest transition in modern history because I don't think he or his team expected to win. So they hadn't prepared anything, nor had they really prepared any coherent policy agendas outside of closing the borders and reducing corporate taxes. And so I think it took them a long time to decide on a course, and even then, they're largely adrift, and largely their course is most sort of clear when they're heading toward his compatriot or his idol, known as the Pale One, who's a sort of a pirate of the seas, loosely based on Putin,
yeah.
And that's sort of, I think, that most sort of crystallizes all of his hopes and dreams is to sidle up next to or have the Pale One and his glamorous and voracious pirates tie up and then plunder the Glory for all that they want, as long as the captain can have an audience with his most esteemed fellow pirate.
Mm-hmm. There's this moment right at the beginning that was kind of, I have to say, it's so sad but so lovely too. I mean, because as the story goes, as you've written it, this is a people of carpenters and teachers and professors and plumbers who, as you say, had developed a sense that they were, as you put it, a mad, ragged quilt of humanity, but unwilling to be separated or torn. Like, that's where we begin in the story, that they're all over the place, sure, but at least they were together in some way.
Yeah, I really do have kind of a corny outlook when it comes to this country. I really, and I think it's partly always reaffirmed when I travel through, you know, like I did. I drove from D.C. To Hershey, stopped on the way, and it's Pennsylvania, such a beautiful state, and I've been in every state. I've driven through every state. I've driven hundreds of thousands of miles around this country. And everywhere I go, without exception, I feel like I can get along with anybody. And we make good people here. I really do think we do. And we share 99.9% of our values. And that's just something that I think that we need to be reminded of. It's just that in this particular case and I – Democrat, Republican, that doesn't matter as much to me in this – you know, as it pertains to the president. Sure, I would vote Democrat, but I do think that we our respect for the dignity of the office and our respect for the rule of law and our interest in liberal democracy, I think these things have to be bedrock issues that we can all agree on outside of policy, outside of sort of the, you know, whatever any given president chooses to do in office. I think that we do have to have the self-respect to take this office seriously and to hold its occupant up to the very highest standards. And somewhere along the line, we've lost that, where we actually do not expect moral behavior from the president. And I really hope we can get back to that and expect more from our elected leaders.
It gets us to an important character in the story, Ava. She's a girl of 12. And Ava is, as you say in the story, flabbergasted at this idea of letting this man be captain. And one of the things she says to the people, and this is the job, they're going to give this job of captain to, the, as you say, the least qualified, least respected man on the ship. And she says, give yourselves some credit. Here's an excerpt from The Captain and the Glory. It comes from the audiobook. It's read by John Hodgman.
We are a noble people with a storied history. We deserve to be led by the most enlightened, reasonable, and honorable among us, not the loudest, cruelest, most selfish, and most foul.
Talk a little bit about the role Ava is playing here.
Well, Ava's the first, the only one. Everyone's sort of debating whether or not they should give the job of captain of a 300,000-ton vessel to somebody who has never read a gauge, never touched any machinery on a boat, and has expressed openly his disdain for all other captains and boats themselves. And so Ava steps up and says, I can't believe this is even being entertained. It's as if everybody has lost their minds. And she, you know, pops up here and there in the book as sort of the moral voice and a voice of moral clarity among the passengers, many of whom are sort of caught in a fever of temporary insanity.
That's the writer Dave Eggers. We're talking about his new book, The Captain and the Glory in Entertainment. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Dave Eggers, who has a new book, a book he wrote to explain the election of Donald Trump. But it's not a book of journalism. It's an absurdist parable. Eggers sets the book on a ship where the passengers have chosen as captain a man with a yellow feather in his hair. It's called The Captain and the Glory, an entertainment. What's the appeal of the man with the yellow feather in his hair for these people? There's this moment where a grandfather of nine, speaks up, and he says, "We need someone like this to shake things up." What do you make of that impulse? As the story goes, the passengers who liked the idea figured that things shaken up, or as you say, as the story goes, randomly tossed into the air, might just come down better. That's the idea behind it, I guess.
I think we've miseducated ourselves. Think about this. We're nearing the end of the year, so people are maybe sending receipts or thinking about their taxes coming up in April. Now, when we hire an accountant, we are looking for the most steady, the most sane, the most rational, reasonable, dependable person we can find, right? And they have to be good at math. And And that's just for our personal taxes. Now, in a way, the president, you would think, when we look for a president, that person has to be even more rational, dependable, reasonable, sane. But somehow, the office of the presidency is held to a lower standard than we would hold our accountant to, or our plumber, or anyone that we work with. Trump, as a co-worker, would not work in any context, and he would be an agent of complete chaos, instability, and madness. But somehow, we find that this is okay for the office of the president. And I think that this is actually a real something that we need to re-educate ourselves as a nation from kindergarten on, to say, no, you know what? This is such a serious responsibility. It has nothing to do with television appeal or glamour or popularity or notoriety. It really has to do with dignity, steadiness, mm-hmm. rationality. Who can sort of collate all of these opinions, make the right decision, represent us well, be a force of moral standing and leadership in that way. And but somehow along the way, we've confused it with sort of survivor-like reality television competitions. And so, we watch these primaries and watch the candidates drop off one by one the same way that we would, single elimination competitions on reality TV. And I do think, the man with the yellow feather is in the book. He was at first a salesman of cheap souvenirs, and he hangs out by the pool and sometimes by the women's locker room. Again, this is a direct parallel because we have a president who sold steaks with his name on them just a few years ago. But we do in this country have a uniquely specific worship of wealth, and we do equate success with and competence with anyone who has made a lot of money and that they can run anything. But there is really a drastic difference between a government and a business, and especially a government and a real estate business. They're just not the same thing. And when people and the Republicans excuse Trump's transactional behavior when it comes to Ukraine, they say, well, he's a businessman, so he's transactional. Well, we're not in a business, where the government is not a business and we cannot treat it as such. We can make it efficient like a business in some ways, but it cannot be transformed into a transactional entity where it's okay to trade favors with a foreign government. It's in this way. So I think that, again, we need to re-educate ourselves. And but I will say I have a story. Like some time ago, I went to a rally in El Paso, and I did run into two T-shirt vendors who – this is sort of encapsulates how we all think. And I think we all do. I think everybody does. And these were two very thoughtful young people that were selling T-shirts, Trump gear, right, in the parking lot. Right. And they've been following him around for years. And they both are supporters of Trump. And one was African-American, one was white. And the young man, African-American man, I said, well, what is it – I asked the woman first. I said, well, what appeals to you about him? And she said, well, he's going to put things in order. This guy puts – things were chaotic before, and he puts things in order. And so she really expressed kind of a view, a tendency to favor authoritarian sort of strong man, somebody who's going to say what's what, speak – coarsely but candidly, and put things in order. And then I asked them both, did they have health insurance? No, they don't have health insurance. Well, how do you get health care? Well, we go into the emergency room. And I proposed the idea that we might as a country increase the taxes on billionaires like Trump and thus fund health care for lower income folks like themselves. And the young man said, well, he can't get behind that. He can't support that because next year he might be a millionaire and he doesn't want his future expected millions taxed anymore. So everybody's planning to be a millionaire, and nobody wants any of their wealth, their presumed wealth of tomorrow taxed any more than it would be, even if it meant, you know, health care for all. It's a very strange mentality, but as warm and generous as we are, I think, as a country, we do have some very strange ideas about wealth, sharing it, and the value of a social safety net.
Here's a moment from the book.
When these previous captains spoke at all, they had expressed themselves with quiet reserve and dignity. They used complicated words regularly, and while giving speeches, they read from note cards, all of which, the supporters of the new captain realized, conveyed dishonesty and a certain palpable elitism. In the eyes of the most foul, though, this new captain was candid and unvarnished. And because he didn't know how to spell and had no taste or manners or filter or shame or sense of what was true and what was false, because he was unscripted when he told lies, he was the most honest captain they'd ever known.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think there's two things. And this was, again, articulated. I interviewed a guy wearing a Santa hat that said, "Make America Great Again." This was last week in Hershey. And he was covered with pins, Trump pins. So I thought he was a all-time, you know, goner for Trump. Turns out he had voted all in for Trump. But before Trump, he voted twice for Obama. And so – and what I got out of him, he was a thoughtful guy. He said, you know, he was really after the purity of conviction in a way. He wanted to be – feel like he was being told the truth, candidly. And – what a lot of people react against is what they think is sort of two-faced, phony political rhetoric, where they're going to say one thing on the debate stage, they're going to act a different way when they're elected, they're going to, you know, lick their finger and see which way the wind's blowing to determine their policies. Somebody that does not have conviction. And so again and again, people have said to me how honest they think Trump is. And these are – and some of the other people I interviewed in Hershey were devout Christians who quoted the Bible extensively and told me that God had sent them to the rally that day and even to a certain door to the rally that they – you know, that, and that was able – they were able to get into an otherwise sold-out rally because God had sent them to the right door. And these were really, really warm people that I liked so much, but – they also thought that Trump was one of the more honest politicians that they've known. And it comes from the candor, because then at the rally, he spoke off the cuff, really without notes, for an hour and 20 minutes. And he probably made up a lot of stuff, but they felt like they were getting the unvarnished thoughts of their elected leader.
Right.
And because I was on the floor, maybe 25 feet away from him, I could see what they what they really felt this time. I thought, you know what? He is just really unfiltered and really, really wanting to talk to them. He does not want to leave the stage at these rallies. And there was a point at every rally where people start leaving because he keeps going on and on.
Yeah.
He is so enjoying that kind of connection with them, this sort of mainlining between the two of them, that he doesn't want to leave. And so I think that that means a lot to people to feel like this, you know, purportedly successful billionaire with his makeup and his hair has come to their town and is just expressing himself openly and nakedly, which he really is. And that feels to them like a direct connection that's more meaningful than the vagaries of correct behavior or even factual fidelity to empirical truth.
It's funny that – I guess what I wondered about that is that wouldn't you think you want – I guess you were referring to this earlier. You'd think would want calm and reserve in a leader.
I guess not. Yeah. You know, and I think, again, it's conflating politics with entertainment.
Yeah.
And I think that we've been on this track for a while, maybe since the beginning. I mean, people used to go to the Lincoln Douglas debates like they would go to a boxing match or go to any other kind of entertainment, bear fighting, you know. And so I think that people have always, especially in this country, and maybe more so here than anywhere, really took an entertainment sort of an approach to it that's far too close to entertainment when we think about it. And that's why we have this long lead up for the election. It's all these – it has whereas the snap elections in other countries just don't allow for that same kind of sort of dramatic build up and the three-act structure and all of these things that we sort of have built into our politics because I don't know. I long for a complete revamping of this system where we are constantly searching for the most almost the most competent but often the most boring person that we can find. I'm here in San Francisco. Our last mayor before London Breed, who's she just was elected and she's trying very hard and has limitless potential, I think. But before him, there was a mayor named Ed Lee who was appointed because the previous mayor was running for higher office. And so Ed Lee was just a guy that knew the government inside and out. He'd been sort of a purchaser and sort of working in the machine rooms of every part of the government. And he was appointed because no one thought he would run again. He was supposed to be a placeholder, and nobody thought he wanted the job, so they gave it to him. And he turned out to be one of everybody's favorite mayors ever because he was so humble and so sort of, you know, he was comfortable enough in the spotlight, but he was not a speech giver. He was not a demagogue or an ideologue or anybody that needed attention that way. He was really like an engine room guy.
He was just competent.
Competent. And so everyone was thought, you know, this guy just does his job. He goes home and he, you know, died of a heart attack while going grocery shopping for his wife, you know. And I think that if we can be more and more attracted to that sort of elected official, humble, somebody that doesn't – I think always we should almost – as frequently as possible, pass over the person that wants the job and go to the number three person, you know?
Yeah.
The person who doesn't even want the VP job, just somebody who's like running the show and from behind the scenes. And if we can sort of elevate that person and give that person the job, I think that we would have a much more ethical and sane democracy.
I have to say there were some some truly horrible deaths conveyed, Dave Eggers, in the book. I mean, the moments when people are tossed overboard and left to die in the waves, I mean, you get really detailed and you get really specific about that. And I wanted to ask you about that part because this happens more than once.
Yeah, I made a really conscious decision to illuminate the horror of the era and not shy away from it. And so again, the day before I went to this Hershey rally in Pennsylvania, I was in Richmond, Virginia, interviewing a young woman who had come from Honduras who was an asylum seeker because she'd been had her life threatened by an ex-boyfriend in Honduras. And so she came here thinking that she and her family would be safe here. She went through all the right processes, but ICE has denied her a court date and has issued final orders of deportation against her. So for the last year and a half, she's been living in the basement of a church in Sanctuary, and she has two American-born children and knows that if she's deported back to Honduras, she'll be killed. And so, you know, countless people, I think, millions of people who have lived in incredible fear, terror during this era where we have ICE breaking down doors and raiding workplaces and luring people out of schools and churches to deport them. And I think it's an era of almost unprecedented cruelty and malice toward immigrants. And so I wanted to kind of balance the sometimes slapstick humor even with the real horror that lives on the other side. The policies are so horrific and so cruel and so against everything that we stand for as a country of welcome and a country of a patchwork of countless and endless diversity that I wanted to sort of have that live right next to a comedy.
I wanted to ask you about the people opposed to all the crazy things the captain is doing on the Glory. And there are various types, some who are just basically catatonic. They don't know what to do. They can't budge. But then there's a group that they call themselves the Kindly Mutineers. And they have this kind of legalistic, tepid response to the captain.
The Kindly Mutineers then filed injunctions and passed resolutions. When these injunctions and resolutions had no effect, they looked in the few remaining ship's manuals, which contained the ship's laws and regulations, to see if the captain had violated any of them. Very quickly, they realized that the captain had violated many hundreds of these laws and regulations, had in fact violated all but a few of them, with astonishing speed and thoroughness. Having realized this, though, the Kindly Mutineers were unsure what step to take next.
And in the end, what they end up doing is just not really doing anything about the captain. Talk about this group, because it seems to be saying something about the way you're seeing people reacting.
Well, I will say I finished the book before the impeachment process began. And so
really?
Oh, yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah, you know. Well, you know, this was at a time when there's a character loosely based on Mueller, the sheriff of the seas, and he issues a report that everybody is very sad to see that it's much too long to read or pay attention to. So nobody does anything. They don't open it, don't read it, and they do nothing about it. Mm. But at the same time, the Kindly Mutineers generally are waiting for some future act that will be so egregious that will get them to finally take action against the captain. I do think as a country we spent a couple years ignoring hundreds of ghastly, unprecedentedly horrific acts and statements that would have caused the implosion of any other presidency, but somehow I was always fascinated to see what it was that those opposed to his presidency and feeling that it was a debasement and a degradation of all we hold true, what they were waiting for. And the Ukraine call, I guess, was it. But there were just so many things before then. And so the Kindly Mutineers are kind of much too polite to trade to fight as dirty, I guess, as the captain would be willing to, and they're waiting for some clear legalistic way to defeat him, which of course is not the way to defeat a captain like this, surrounded by, you know, the cruelest and most ruthless pirates and cronies. So, but what was funny, you know, I wrote it and I said, well, inevitably things are going to change. But I did want to publish it while Trump was still president and knowing things might change in the year or so left. And it was interesting. I think it was the book was at press or maybe being shipped from the printer when the impeachment hearings were announced. And so it was interesting to see how it might have been affect the reading, but I tried to make it timeless enough that even if this were read 20 years from now by somebody that doesn't even know who Trump is, it would still have resonance in how anyone, any country, often uses or abandons, I think, the more rational parts of their brain to support either a clownish leader or a strongman. And I think that around the world, again and again, you see from Erdogan, who has a lot of popular support, Putin has enormous popular support in Russia. Again and again, I think that liberal democracy is the exception. I think the rule is that somebody wants the boss man to that the electorate generally wants somebody to say what's what, to cruelly punish offenders, and to lay out a very clear path for what's right and wrong to get things done without opposition, and they don't want the mess of what democracy represents, the process, the back and forth, the checks and balances, sometimes the long waiting to get things done, the endless debate. All of these things are not inherently appealing, I think, to a large part of the world's population.
And the book was saying to me also that those who are opposed, the kindly mutineers, that the longer they dither, you know, the more that kind of behavior just becomes normalized.
Yeah, I think that life on the ship, because eventually the snowmen start putting, at the suggestion of the Pale One and another pirate, Bloodbeard, they start putting their unwanted passengers, not just throwing them overboard, but putting them in cages so that they send a signal of unwelcome to anybody else who might be wanting to come to the ship from poor vessels from around the sea. Life becomes a lot nastier. They're surrounded by the evidence of their complicity with this cruelty. They can't go outside their cabins because of the stench of rotting flesh, the presence of these pirates that they've invited aboard who have stolen anything that isn't battened down. There's a certain lawlessness to it and a nastiness to it that that they didn't necessarily sign up for, but they have not curbed in any way. And I think that, you know, that's what's so often confusing, I think, about meeting and enjoying conversations with people that might vote for Trump based on a narrow issue like, well, they, you know, they like his tax policies, or they like they have members of their family in the military who they want to come home. And but at the same time, especially, you know, those who are devout Christians among them, supporting very unchristian behavior and very unchristian attitudes towards refugees, toward the most vulnerable. There is no way to more invert the teachings of Christ and the Bible than what we've seen from the last 2-3 years, this incredible naked cruelty toward anyone who is other, anyone who is most needing, Christian charity, for lack of a better expression. And so at this rally in Hershey, this was the most sort of religious presence I'd seen at any rally in terms of T-shirts and people I interviewed and sort of church groups you saw going in. There was a whole Orthodox Jewish group of teenagers with Make America Great yarmulkes. And in any teachings of any of the major faiths, there's just nothing that we're seeing right now is echoed in any of the teachings of the major faiths. And it's very interesting to see how they square those two things. And again, I think it's only this one man that can so confuse so many people, I think. And so trick them into acting or supporting all of these policies that are truly against the teachings of every one of their texts.
We don't have to give too much away, but there's a moment in the end that's really hopeful. I mean, the 12-year-old girl, Ava, she leads the passengers into restoring order again. And I wonder, is there going back? Like in that, not just in that story, of course, but do you feel like there's a way to go back in the real situation, not to some ideal time, but to a time when, you know, as you said earlier, we weren't as willing to be separated or torn? Do you feel hopeful about that?
I do. I think that this is a really once in a nation's history kind of fever that has taken hold among a lot of people. And it's possible because of one very charismatic person who has no precedent in Republican Party history, and I don't think will have any successor. And so we've had charismatic leaders for sure, and maybe the last truly charismatic Republican would have been Reagan, but he was a man of decency, you know, and calm and tolerance, and whatever his faults and whatever policy disagreements we may have, he at least respected the dignity of the office. And so, you know, I think that there is no one waiting in the wings to be the next Trump, unless it's Donald Jr., who is a truly terrifying person as a potential leader. He has, if you can believe it, I think as a hunter and as a killer of animals, and I think he might have more malice in a way than his father, and he does have the political fire in the belly. I've seen him speak, and he is just as effective as a speaker to the faithful. But I think that the checks and balances have curbed Trump's power. I think that we have seen civil servants from Yovanovitch to Bill Taylor and on emerge and show just how many truly idealistic and competent and even inspiring people there are all throughout the government, and there are, and I've always believed this. And I think, you know, in The Captain and the Glory, things get to a place where they are so black and so dark and so upside down, but the captain abandoned ship and looks out for himself in the end, and no one ever sees him again, and leaving the residents of the ship and also refugees from the seas at large to come in and remind the Glory's passengers of what the ship stands for and what has been inspiring about it and why people typically go there and see it as a beacon of hope. And I think the newer Americans, you know, tend to dream the American dream better and harder and deeper and more profoundly sometimes than we do, who have been here, you know, a couple generations or more. I think the newest Americans are sometimes the most entrepreneurial, the most fervent in their belief in what the country stands for. They can appreciate it, having been maybe refugees from a country at war or refugees from a country where human rights are not respected or there is no rule of law or constitution. So I think that, you know, I wanted to reflect that at the end of this book, that it is people from afar that come to the ship and say, you know, I can't believe you've forgotten all of what has inspired us all from afar for all these generations. And they come and restore a little bit of that hope and a little bit of that belief in sort of the higher ideals that have typically marked these small boats, rafts, junks, dinghies, come from every side of the sea and approach the Glory, and it's their passengers who are the most needy and but also the most inspired by the Glory, and they come aboard and they see this desiccated hulk of a ship with its catatonic and soul-shaken passengers, and they say, you know, what happened here? And don't you remember what you represent and how and why the rest of us around the world were so inspired by you? And it becomes the responsibility of these new arrivals to reawaken the hope, relight the flame, you know, and restore the Glory to what it was.
Dave Eggers, his new book is The Captain and the Glory, an entertainment. Our thanks to Penguin Random House Audio for letting us play some of the audiobook version of The Captain and the Glory. It was narrated by John Hodgman. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Viarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.